When Suicide is Murder is a podcast that uses adult language, discusses topics that may be sensitive and triggering. Listener discretion is advised. It is estimated that each year, approximately 1 million people die from suicide. That equals about one death every 40 seconds. There's a myth that once someone is suicidal, he or she will be suicidal forever. Actually, people who want to kill themselves are only suicidal for a limited period of time. Mostly, it's because they want to escape a situation that they feel is just unbearable. If you think you know someone who is contemplating suicide, the best thing you can do is talk to them about getting help and see what you can do. Lynn Lemke was born Lynn Suzette York on August 1, 1955, and died at the young age of 34 on October 4, 1989. In this podcast, I'm going to dive deep into the weird circumstances surrounding the life and death of Lynn Lemke. There is a crazy family history that involves sex, biker gangs, failed marriages, and broken homes. Lynn Lemke's death was listed as a suicide, but she ended up in an unmarked grave as a final fuck you from her husband. It's going to be a long road to discovery on how exactly to obtain her remains and put them to a peaceful rest. She deserves better, and this is something her family desperately seeks. Someone said to me, "I've never heard of this case." The only thing I could come up with was that, well, this is the kind of shit that no one wants to talk about. Some things are so taboo that they just get pushed back so far out of our minds that they get forgotten in a sense. Lynn was never forgotten, but hidden, and her story was left behind, tangled in a web that no one wanted to disturb. I'm here to shake things up. I believe she was not trash to be discarded by the police department. The tragic life and death of Lynn Lemke is my personal investigation into how she came to be dispositioned in an unmarked grave for 31 years and my journey to the truth. This is also a call to action. I'm seeking information from the San Diego area and beyond to give me some insight on anything and everything they knew about her and her husband. I want it all revealed. The good, the bad, the ugly, you name it, I want it. Because no matter what, it's part of the story. And while the story is being unfolded, ugly shit might come out, it still doesn't change the fact that she did not deserve a disgraceful burial. I want to start out by telling the story as the family knew it for an eternity of 31 years. This is how Lynn died, by suicide. Around 8 p.m. on the evening of Wednesday, October 4th, Phil Lemke arrived home to a wife that he observed to be in a severe state of depression. She then presented him with a 3-page letter saying that she was very unhappy with the marriage and wanted a divorce. Phil then went into the bathroom to shower. He came out about 20 minutes later and searched for his wife. He found Lynn laying behind the bedroom door. He thought that she was playing a joke on him, so he grabbed her by the arm and he thought he felt a faint pulse. It was then that he saw the blood and thought that it was makeup. After the realization that it was actually blood, he then picked up the gun off of the floor and smelled it to be sure that it had been fired. He then called 911 for help. The 911 call was received at 8:33 p.m. and paramedics arrived on scene at 8:36. At 8:40 p.m., the El Cajon police received a radio call about a suicide victim with a gunshot wound to the chest and proceeded to the two-story apartment building. Upon their arrival, Phil was standing outside of the apartment by the front door. He told police that his wife had just shot herself and there was a 3-page letter contemplating suicide in a dresser drawer. He also stated that she had a previous suicide attempt. They went into the bedroom, and what they saw was Lynn, lying on her back with her legs crossed and her head partially blocking the door. She was visibly not breathing and appeared to have no pulse. The police gave her CPR until the paramedics arrived. And then she was moved into the living room where she could be further assisted and revival procedures performed by the paramedics and firefighters. LifeLite received a call at 8:43 p.m. and were en route to the closest location by 8:49. The location was a schoolyard about 4 minutes away from Lynn's home. They arrived on scene at 8:47. Lynn was presumed dead on arrival at 9:02 p.m. I'm unaware of what exactly happened with her body next, as those files are being withheld by the police department. While firefighters and paramedics did their part, they found the bullet hole 4 feet above the floor in the back of the door, exiting the other side and going into the adjacent wall 8 feet high just below the ceiling. At this point, the officer concluded that Lynn had gotten down on her knees with her back to the bedroom door, put the loaded gun to her chest, and pulled the trigger. When the investigating officers and deputy coroner came on the scene, they were made aware that Phil did not hear the shot because he was in fact in the shower. They went to the bathroom, where they saw a wet bath towel and men's underwear on the floor, and this is when they confirmed that the shower had been used. They found 3 pages of writing in a dresser drawer. There was no indication of suicide, and the letter had no signature. However, they were able to conclude that Lynn was severely depressed. They found the gun next to where Lynn's feet had been, with a bag of ammunition. They took a picture. Then they removed the one spent shell casing that had been in the gun and placed them both into evidence. They viewed 2 Polaroid photos. One was of the entrance wound and the other was of the exit. They placed 3 photos, one RG-31 special revolver handgun, one spent shell casing, and the bag of ammunition into evidence and concluded that Lynn had taken her own life. The police also did a witness check, and many neighbors heard the single shot but did not actually witness Lynn shoot herself. The forensic pathologist at the coroner's office was informed this was a suicide victim. The autopsy was performed. The coroner made his conclusion. He states his findings are based on her letter indicating severe depression, a previous suicide attempt, evidence collected at the scene, statements from her husband, and the autopsy report. He wrote, quote, "The descendant, in a deliberate act of self-destruction, purposefully inflicted a fatal gunshot wound to her chest. Therefore, the mode of death is to be suicide," end quote. She was then cremated and her remains were picked up by her husband. She was placed into a grave with the request that there be no marker, and Phil died, never telling her family where she was. So by now you must be thinking, what the fuck just happened? Was that story real? Yeah, it sure was. That is exactly what happened according to the reports I have. Is there anything about that whole story that is not questionable? The part about him coming home and the letter raise some of my deepest concerns. I have her letter. Well, not the actual letter, because by law, they can only release it to the person that it is addressed to. But I found a way around that, and I was able to transcribe her final words without someone actually giving me the letter. And that letter is huge in this story. But first, there are so many questions you probably have, and so do I. So let's go ahead and dig into that. What in the hell is up with the timelines? I really hope that they were accidental report typos. It does make me think that they just did not give a shit when they did their so-called investigation. They couldn't correctly report what time each person arrived on scene. However, by putting everything together myself, it is clear that first the police arrived, then the paramedics and firefighters, and then she was taken to Life Flight at the schoolyard. But they couldn't even read the report to fix the error times? Next is the 13-minute gap. Why is there a 13-minute gap between finding his wife's body and calling for help? In an emergency situation, when you are panicked, even 1 minute can seem to take an eternity. You would be freaking out, right? You would be on the phone right then and staying on the phone until someone arrived. I know that if I found my spouse laying on the floor, I would be screaming. I'd be shaking him, holding him. I wouldn't want to leave his side. You would have to rip my emotional ass away and hold me back. I know people can react differently to situations when in distress or during an emergency, but the time gap and him standing outside waiting for police to arrive came across as more than strange to me. I have requested the 911 call as it is supposed to be public record. At this time, the police are trying to keep it from me, and trust me, I will get to that. Hopefully soon, but not until later. When the police arrived, Phil immediately told them that Lynn committed suicide, and the letter proving so was in a dresser drawer. That right there was suspicious to me. Maybe he was worried they would think that he did it, so he spit that out in fear. Or maybe he knew the power of suggestion and used it to his advantage because of how things looked. It's obvious to me that the police didn't feel a need to even look at things as closely as they should have. So maybe this is why her death was only ever investigated as a suicide. And it's funny that it trickled down from there. From Phil to the police to everyone else, suicide was a fact to be verified and not to be questioned. They did question Phil. They held him in custody, but it was short-lived. And I don't have much information on his interview, but I do know that he was out that same night. His interview is actually part of the records that the police are still withholding. He didn't hear the gunshot. How is that even possible? Because of a shower? Yeah, I don't think so. There's a couple of reasons to question this. In the reports I have, it states that many neighbors heard the shot. I actually went to the apartment complex where she died. The manager was so kind. She let me into the apartment. Not that exact apartment, but the one next door, which is currently vacant. Side note, in the next episode, there's also a short little ghost story that goes along with the apartment she died in. So, the apartments mirror each other, so essentially, they're exactly the same, just flip-flop. It's a two-bedroom apartment. When you walk in, there's a big living room space with a big picture window, to the left of the door. Walking forward into the living room would put the kitchen and the dining area directly in front of you, toward the back of the apartment. There's a partial wall that separates the kitchen from the living room, but leaves the open dining space. The bedroom and bathroom are to the right of the front door as you're walking in. If you were to turn, like you're going to walk into the hallway, you would be facing the bathroom exactly. There's a bedroom on the left and on the right. So when you're facing the bathroom, the tub is along the back side of the wall long ways, which means that it shares a wall with each of the bedrooms. So it's not like the shower was to one side or the other. He couldn't claim that he was in the shower and she was in the opposite room from the one he was attached to, because he was attached to both in the shower. There was an equal opportunity, no matter what room it happened in, for him to have heard the shot. Not to mention where they found her and how small the apartment is, she was literally about 10 feet from the shower or less. Her body placement in conjunction with the bullet trajectory is completely off. The officers and Phil both say that they found her on her back, but there's never anything indicating if her body was moved prior to the police getting there, which seems odd to me. The police officers came to a conclusion that she had knelt in front of the door and placed the gun to her chest. Well, the bullet is 8 feet high in the adjacent wall. She would have had to have been leaning forward quite a bit for the trajectory to have been that high. If that's the case, then why was she on her back with her legs crossed? And why was the gun by where her feet were? I would think that with that kind of an upward angle, she would have had to have fallen forward to some extent, and there was no reason for her head to be kind of blocking the door. So her body placement in conjunction with the bullet trajectory is very suspicious. Now, I want to talk about the previous suicide attempt. She took some pills many years before they were married. I haven't pinned down exactly when that was yet, but I do have a close enough range from speaking with her family. So what they have said is that it was something to do with being a young mother and her children being placed into custody with Child Protective Services. That was at somewhere around 7 years prior, and it was something that she had come to terms with. I'm going to dig a little more into that later as I unravel some of the family history. But by using her previous attempt to justify her being suicidal is not comparable in my opinion. The love that a mother has for her children and guilt surrounding that is not comparable to grief over a failed marriage, from what I gather, so far was only a couple of years long. The other thing is, she came to terms with that enough to be able to talk about it, to share that very private fact of her life with her husband. Moving on to evidence, or a lack thereof, to be frank. The evidence taken into custody was three pictures, the gun, bullets, shell casing, and the letter. Where's the rest of the evidence? The bullet that went through her body still remains in the wall of that apartment to this day. They decided there was no need to remove it. There was no fingerprinting done. Also, there was no gunshot residue testing done, not on him, not on her, to confirm anything. I would assume that it would be common practice to at least take all precautions and test everything. It's kind of to me like how innocent until proven guilty type of thing. Don't you want to go through the evidence and prove what you're trying to say happened, rather than not put any effort into it? Because that's what it looks like. And there are no photos of her body or the room where she was found. That seems odd to me. Oh, and speaking of evidence, where are Phil's clothes? The ones from before he took a shower? Because he alleged that he took a shower after they fought. However, how can we know when he took a shower? All they did was confirm that the shower had been used. Why not question when it had been used? What if there was blood on his clothing and he showered after something wrong happened? Would that be part of the 13-minute gap? He had to take a shower for some reason? If you thought you felt a faint pulse, why wait 13 minutes to call an ambulance? And this also might seem odd, but I kind of wondered why the towel and the underwear were not taken into evidence, just in case there was anything on them. Let's go back to the letter for a brief moment. And yes, I'm going to circle back to that repeatedly because it says so much. Had this information been viewed under unbiased eyes, maybe this podcast wouldn't even exist. The letter that was taken into evidence did not mention she was suicidal at all. It was said to be a 3-page letter. I found out that it was 1 page and 2 half pages. It was not signed. To me, it feels like a rough draft. Or maybe she was working on a script on what to say to him and was piecing it together over time. Phil said that Lynn presented him with this letter and that he could tell she was severely depressed. However, if you could see in someone that their face and body language is telling you that there is something very wrong, why would you turn around and go get in the shower? And when did she give him this letter, and how did it get back in the dresser drawer? Also, it never says whether the letter was in her dresser drawer or his. And if you think about the fact that it could be a draft or a script, where the letter was placed would be significant. To me, there's only 2 reasons you would put someone in an unmarked grave and not tell anyone. The first reason is guilt. The second reason is anger. If we're talking about the anger, I would ask myself, would a person that was so upset over their wife committing suicide really put them in an unmarked grave? Why not ever tell anyone where she was? The other thing is guilt. Now, if we look at the guilt factor, there's 2 kinds of guilt. One would be the guilt for causing her so much pain she felt she had to take her own life. The second would be a guilty conscience over something you did wrong. But if we look at the first type, guilt over causing someone that kind of pain wouldn't exactly make it a reason to not give her a marker and, again, not tell anyone where she was. He actually told her family that they would never find her ashes. Why? Lynn's mother, Anita, died, never knowing where her daughter was. When she died, she was buried in the plot that had been waiting for Lynn. She now rests there with others of the family who have also passed on since then, not ever getting the chance to find out where Lynn's remains were buried. Those aren't the only questions I have, but those are some of the most obvious ones. I do have much more to dig into, and you can follow along with me as things are still happening and there is work to be done. Obtaining her ashes is a big part of this. As it stands now, Phil died owning the rights to them. Her son Stephen is currently seeking the rights to the plot and her remains. Lynn was my aunt. She was my mother's sister. In the next episode, I'm going to discuss how I found her remains and what started me on this journey. I'm your host, Jill Starr. This podcast is compiled of my own case files I obtained through family, public record, interviews, and personal conclusions. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing. Please take a moment to visit my website, suicidecrime.com. There you can find many ways to support my podcast, including a link to my Patreon, where you can get access to bonus content, pictures, documents, and branded merch.